enhance value. Second issue, I think you can focus on underlying assumptions of many of these claims that are made, value, language, policy assumptions. This kind of argument is referred to as critiquing, primarily from policy debate, but it obviously exists in the literature, that literature refers to critiques and criticism of the ideas that people advance. And really what you're doing is simply examining the underlying assumptions. You're identifying the differences in perspective that people have, and you're finding argumentation based on those differences. And so I think it's a fairly simple device. Now, some of these come from the language choices that people make. If there's heterosexist language because of the exclusive use of male pronouns to describe the world, you might argue against someone who takes that kind of rhetorical approach in a debate. But this might not be satisfactory. After all, you're not reading evidence from other experts in the debate. Your credibility is all you have when you make a presentation. And anything that undermines your credibility means that the people who are in the audience, the judge, who's the principal member of the audience that you focus your attention on, the judge, after all, has the ballot, that person needs to trust what you have to say. And in any way in which you undermine your credibility, you won't be able to establish trust with the judge. So if you engage in racist or sexist or homophobic language in your presentation, there's no reason for anyone to pay attention to the other issues that you're advancing. Hitler was a vegetarian. I'm not sure that you want to you give Hitler credibility because of his vegetarianism, or he was nice to pets. It's his other rhetoric and other behavior and policies that undermine his credibility so thoroughly that you can't listen to any other ideas that he advances, because there's no trust that that you have with someone. Now, you're not actually calling your opponents Hitler in the debate. You're not like the U.S. government labeling anyone that it wants to bomb as the new Hitler. Oh, my opponents. Yes, they're from the University of Colorado, the source of all the new Hitlers. And you're not labeling your opponents that way, but it is an issue of credibility in relative terms. You establish your credibility with the audience, and if your opponent undermines their credibility, and you're talking about issues in like ways, well, you end up with one speaker who has a powerful presentation and a respondent who has a diminished response. And if they talk about like things in the debate, at the end of the debate, the judge will decide with the person that has the most credibility on this issue. This can also be used as a technique, not just about the arguments and the rhetoric that are advanced in the debate, but obviously the substantive claims of issues. You can explore underlying assumptions of, if we take the example of the debate the other night, you can explore the underlying assumptions of claims for the environment or for economic growth. And you don't have to debate the issue at a superficial level. You can examine all of the claims that serve as a foundation that reaches the point in which we say, well, protection of the environment is a worthwhile thing. The final thing that I want to talk about involves this issue of policy options and alternatives. And I will begin. We're going to have another presentation about this. This is actually the issue of counterpositions and counterplans. And I think they're valuable devices in a debate. And I want to talk to you about it in this way. This is in strictly policy debate terms, so that you understand a way in which you have a formula that you can use to decide whether or not an argument is relevant in a debate. But I don't want you to use this language in a debate. It might be too confusing for many of the judges that you will have. But here's the formula for determining whether or not any counterposition or counterplan that's presented is a relevant idea for the discussion. Oops, sorry. And in debate terminology, this is this expression. A counter plan is net beneficial to the perm. The counter plan is net beneficial to the perm. This explains the relevance of an idea. Now let me explain it to you in normal language. By the way, you use this argument all the time. There's no argument that I'm talking about that isn't part of normal conversation. What we do is we take the way in which we're effective in one setting in debate and translate that into another setting. And so you use counter plans, competing alternatives all the time. If someone says to you, do you want to go to dinner tonight at 6 o'clock? And someone else says to you, do you want to go to a movie tonight at 6 o'clock? Then they're different people and they don't get along with each other and you have to make a decision. Well, you're making a competing choice. You make choices, you make so many choices a day, you probably couldn't add them all up. If someone tracked you with a video camera, as Greta is me right now, you couldn't go back and deconstruct it and figure out all the choices that would be made in a day. There'd be too many thousands of choices. You know how to make choices. This is what this is about. So if we start here with this part of the formula, and this talks about the option advanced by the government, a plan, and the option advanced by the opposition, a counterplan. If you can put those ideas together, you don't have to make a choice, do you? If someone says, all right, let's go to the movie and go to dinner, and because one is at 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock, do you have to make a choice about whether or not you'll pick one or the other? No. And so there's no choice that's forced. You can have the entire world at your feet. You can select all of the particular options that are available. In policy terms, what if the issue is, should the United States engage in humanitarian intervention? And someone says, well, I've got a better idea for the United States. The United States should be involved in refugee assistance. Well, why is that a counterplan or counterposition that's advanced in a debate? Why should the United States both be involved in humanitarian intervention and be involved in refugee assistance? The government could do that. Well, you might argue that there are finite resources for it. But I don't believe that that's ever an issue in debate, and usually not an issue for the government now that it's got a $3 trillion surplus coming up in the next 10 years. Well, I'm going to talk about the issue of mutual exclusivity in a second. But I do believe that in most terms, if you're able to demonstrate that these are two good ideas that are complementary, there's no choice that's forced in the debate, and as a result, the government ought to win. Because this demonstrates that the argument that's advanced by the opposition doesn't come at the expense of the government's position in the debate. And so if they are able to permute, to offer a permutation of the positions in the debate, and so that you could have both, then it demonstrates, in practical terms, that there is no opposition to their presentation. So it's necessary for you, if you present a counterplan or counterposition, to show that the counterplan alone is better than the selection of both of these together. If you're able to do that, you're able to show that there is forced choice in the debate. Obviously, if the plan alone is better than the plan plus the counterplan, this is not a reason to vote for the opposition in the debate. This is a reason to vote for the government in a debate. If this is a strategy for the opposition. So the only way in which this makes sense is to say that the counterplan alone is net beneficial, has greater benefits than the permutation. And this is a way to test the legitimacy of counterplans. If you present a counterplan in a debate, it has to meet this formula. If someone presents one against you in a debate, you can test this to determine whether or not it forces a choice between the positions advanced by the government and the opposition. Now, there are a couple of myths about counterplans that I'd like to address. One is one that Don just mentioned, that a counterplan must be mutually exclusive. Let me give you an example. Is it possible for the U.S. government to pass simultaneously legislation that says we will withdraw from NATO and we will dramatically increase our troop strength in NATO. Is it technically possible for the Congress or for the Secretary of Defense to have that kind of rulemaking?
Technically.
Sure. They could do that. The Secretary of Defense could come out and say, we're withdrawing from NATO. And then Cohen could show up later, 5 seconds later and say, we're going to add 500,000 troops to NATO. I mean, he could do it. But what would be the consequence of doing both of those actions at the same time? It would destroy the credibility of U.S. foreign policy. It would undermine any commitments to NATO, even if you tried to increase the strength that you gave to NATO. It would undermine U.S. resolve for other treaty agreements that we had. In other words, picking one of these, the option that the opposition might present, would be better than doing both of these at the same time, because they work against each other, and that there are more advantages to one than to doing both. And so it's not to say that mutual exclusivity is not a good argument. It's only to say that mutual exclusivity is a subset of net benefit explanations of the way in which plans and counterplans interact in a debate. The second myth about counterplans is that they must accomplish what the government is trying to accomplish in the debate. In other words, they must have the same advantages. False. They are not designed necessarily to capture the same advantages. Some of them are. Some of them would like to capture the same advantage that the government's talking about. The government identifies a problem and you say, you know what, that is a problem, but we've got a better solution and it's a competing solution. You've got to pick one or the other, and ours produces better advantages. It not only solves that problem, but does so more efficiently, it does so for a lower cost, it does so, it produces ancillary benefits. There are all those kinds of advantages associated with it. You might have a counter policy in a debate that accomplishes that. But it's not necessarily the case. Let's go back to the example that I just gave. One reason that we might withdraw from NATO is to increase the strength of European common defense. The EU might want to move to establish their own defense relations, and this might be a positive thing for negotiation and peace in Europe. And so that might be the reason to withdraw from NATO. The reason to add more troops to NATO is so that NATO can be involved in more action for humanitarian intervention around the world. Well, in that circumstance, the ideas certainly compete with each other. We can't simultaneously, in practice, go ahead and withdraw from NATO and add to NATO. But what about the advantages? One talks about European security and defense agreements among European nations, and that being a benefit. But the other one talks about humanitarian intervention by NATO being a benefit. These are not the same advantages. One's not trying to capture the other one. What are you trying to do when you present that counterposition? You're trying to outweigh the permutation, the combination of both of them. And so it's acceptable for you to present different advantages. Now these things, I think, because they are powerful myths, you've got to explore these with judges. And we'll talk about judge adaptation at a later point, but I think it's important for you to educate your judges all the time. And you can do it in debates, but you can also do it informally out of debates. And I think you can give quick explanations about how mutual exclusivity is not the only way to understand counterplans, and whether or not they are relevant in a debate, and that they don't necessarily seek to accomplish the same thing that a government wants to accomplish with its policy. Yes, Andy, you had a question or
an issue. If you're getting to this next, I'm sorry, but it's also really important they must be counter-revolutional. The opposition can't advance a resolutional counterpoint.
Well, I think that this is a debatable question. That, yes, that I think it's possible to argue that they have to be in opposition to the policy that's advanced by the government. And it's always easy, I think, to make them outside the resolution. But I don't think that of necessity, of logical necessity, they need to be other than what the government has defined as its policy. The reason why is this is what I think is going on when there's interpretation. You have a topic, and the topic is interpreted by the government. And so the government has its interpretation. Once the government interprets it, this is what you're debating about. You're not debating about the topic anymore. You're debating about their interpretation of the topic. And so these other possibilities for interpreting the topic, they now sit outside what is the resolution in practical terms in the debate, which is now the government's position in the debate. And so I think you're right about this, that it needs to be other than the resolution, but it doesn't have to be other than this resolution. It has to be other than this resolution.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's where I think there are some possibilities for
the
option.
Showing a better option that they should have employed to uphold the resolution.
And exactly. Sean, did you have...
I was just thinking that if you got to be careful with the counterplan, and some of the rules are designed to help you avoid this, but if you leave the government with a reason to support the proposition, however they the proposition that they interpreted it, then there's a reason to vote for the government.
Correct.
If it's just proposing another government another time or something like that, they're irrelevant to the case.
Correct, which might be this issue, that there's still a reason left to support the government, or that the operation of the plan produces more benefits than the counterplan. But a counterplan, in principle, actually expresses a disadvantage in a debate. It says if you take this course of action, there's an opportunity cost because there's another choice that one could have made that competes with this one that produces greater benefits. And so to select that action, it functions as a disadvantage because you lose the opportunity of having these larger benefits. And so it functions the same way that a disadvantage does in a debate. And if the benefits are indeed larger, well, you ought to win the debate. And so I agree with you that you have to make sure that the counterplan does, in fact, outweigh what the permutation would be. Certainly what the government says are their advantages of the debate. Otherwise, you don't give the judge a reason for a significant opportunity cost. Yes?
I just think that you have to, then the mutually exclusive standard isn't a myth, because you have, if they can, you can do your counterplan separately later, then it isn't, that's not a reason to avoid the plan, unless there's no way to do both.
Well, not that there's no way, but that it would be a bad idea, that these don't interact together at any point in time,
right,
that you would do them. For example, if we take the NATO case, it's not that you couldn't do both of those, but at the point at which you ever tried to do both, it would be counterproductive relative to choosing one. If everyone will take a break for a few minutes, and then we'll reconvene at 11. Thanks very much for your time.